Tarzan, Teddy Roosevelt, and the Vanishing Frontier. Enter Joseph Knowles, a one-time hunting guide, naval veteran, and artist. He said he would walk into the wilds of Maine clad in nothing but an athletic supporter, and then emerge 2 months later clothed for the streets of town and healthy. Sound like an episode of Survivor? Come on, you admit it. You knew that TV show wasn't really an original idea, didn't you? Anyway, Joseph Knowles apparently made good on his claim. Fast forward to 2008 and a new book about Knowles and his era called Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. Today, we speak with the author of that book, Jim Motivelli, getting the author and the character mixed up. He's the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. You can check that out at www.emagazine.com. And he joins us by phone. Good morning and welcome to the program. Okay, I don't hear Mr. Motivelli, so somebody needs to push another button someplace. Let me give the phone numbers for people who might want to join this conversation this morning. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. That's a toll-free number. In Milwaukee, please use our local number, 414-227-2050, 227-2050. And Jim Motivelli, are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, great. Otherwise, this would be a really short program.
Thanks for joining me here, and you're right to confuse me with Joseph Knowles because I sometimes identify with him so strongly that our names begin to merge.
Okay, well, we'll get into that later. First of all, I would like you to start out by telling the audience about Andrew Kimball Weegar.
Well, Andrew Kimball Weegar is the person who told me about Joseph Knowles and his adventures in the woods, and it was 1999. I was on a trip with the Institute of Journalism and Natural Resources in Maine, and we did sort of a tour of Maine, and we did a lot of the things you do in Maine, including whitewater rafting. And Andrew Weegar was sort of a Renaissance man. He was like an historian of Maine. He was a writer. He had graduated from Harvard Divinity School. He restored houses. He built canoes. He was really quite an interesting character. And while we were whitewater rafting on the Kennebec, he told me the story of Joseph Knowles in the woods of Maine in 1913. And right after he told me that, I was dumped in the water when we hit a rock. So it probably was one of the reasons it stayed in my mind so clearly that it was a vivid story. It took me something like 7 years. And unfortunately, in that time, Weegar himself passed away because he was involved in a bizarre tractor accident. And he's no longer with us, but he planted the seed that grew into this book.
Set the scene for us. What was America like in the early part of the second decade of the 20th century?
Well, I think this was a time of extreme dislocation for a lot of people, because in 1913, half of the American people still lived on farms, but the transition was being made rather abruptly into urban lifestyles, and America was industrializing. The frontier had been reached. California was no longer, isolated on the coast there, and, the West had largely been subdued, and there was no more territory to explore. That was a big change in the American psyche. And people were moving to cities, they were taking jobs in factories, and there was a lot of anxiety. Right at that time, you had Tarzan of the Apes had just been published in serial form, and one of the big bestsellers was Jack London's Call of the Wild. So people were interested in this connection to nature that they felt they were losing. That's why I say that Joe Knowles was very much tapping into a vein of wilderness anxiety. His timing was excellent. He couldn't have picked a better time to go into the woods.
What was it that made him decide to pull that stunt?
Well, he had been boasting around the bars of Boston that he could go naked into the woods and that he would be able to clothe himself and find food, and he would live like a king because he had all these wilderness skills. And he happened to be talking about this one time when a newspaper reporter was in the bar with him, This is my, some of this is all my conjecture because it wasn't totally spelled out, but it seems to have occurred this way. And the reporter said, we could make a mint on this. This is really timely. So they brought it to the Boston Post newspaper, and Knowles had worked there part-time as a newspaper artist, so he was a known quantity there. And this idea of going naked into the woods, some say that because Tarzan had just been published, the newspapers were looking for a similar man-in-the-woods kind of stunt, and that was an impetus. That's unclear, but what is certain is that the newspaper really settled on this. And I think initially they didn't realize it was going to be a huge promotion for them. They had a lot of things that they were doing like this because the Post had lost a lot of circulation. For instance, they did things like they bought circus elephants, and they had kids send in dimes to help pay for it. And every day, if you picked up the paper, you could find how close they were to handing the elephants over to the zoo, that kind of thing. They did lots of contests, any stunt to get the paper in the news. So when Knowles' story appeared, they saw it as manna from heaven. But initially, it was sort of in the back pages of the paper. And only after he'd been in the woods for a little while did people realize that he was going to be a huge hit, and he was moved to the front page. He was enormously popular. He doubled the circulation of the newspaper.
And he sent his dispatches on birch bark written in charcoal, did he?
He did indeed. And he, in addition to just doing a sort of diary of what was happening to him, he illustrated the dispatches with charcoal drawings of animals that he'd seen in the woods. And I think that increased their popularity. He was in many ways one of the first reality-type stars, you could say. I mean, it was before TV, but if they'd had TV, he would have been on TV. And right now, there are shows like Man vs. Wild featuring Bear Grylls. And it's pretty much the same story. Man vs. Wild is Joe Knowles, 90 years later.
Yeah, there aren't any original ideas left anymore, are there?
No.
Do you believe that he really did all the things that he said he did? I know there was some speculation at the time, particularly by rival newspapers, that he really hadn't been able to live for those 2 months off the land, and that he had a secret stash of food someplace.
Right. This is one of the funny things about his story. Around this time, he came out of the woods after 2 months in 1913, and he received a tumultuous welcome, something like 200,000 people in the streets of Boston, which was a third of the city's population at that time. And he got enormous amounts of acclaim. Even the other papers were forced to cover his appearances in the city over the next few days. And obviously, the other papers were very jealous of the fact that the Post had experienced such circulation gains. So several days after he came out of the woods, the rival paper, the Hearst newspaper, the Boston American, published an expose which said that Knowles had actually been staying in a comfortable cabin, and that the bear skin that he wore with such acclaim, and of course his column told the story of how he'd captured the bear in a bear pit and dispatched it with a club, and that was one of the more successful things he did. They said that he had actually bought it from a trapper, and there were bullet holes in the bear skin and all this kind of thing. And Knowles saw this as fighting words. He responded, spirited rebuttal, which was also front page news, and it went back and forth. I think the weight of evidence is that he really did have assistance in the woods. He really did fake at least some of his exploits there. And it's kind of ironic because he did go back in the woods two other times after this through 1916. And all the evidence is that on the second trip, which he also completed on the California-Oregon border, he did not have assistance and he was successful. And I think there's no doubt that he had the wilderness skills to carry that off. But he was also a fairly lazy guy, and if he didn't have to be naked in the woods, he wasn't going to. Also, he knew the woods of Maine very well, and he had many accomplices there, which he did not have later in California. So the available evidence suggests that he was partly a fraud and partly not.
Well, you talk about wilderness skills. There was, I believe, and you talk about this a little bit in your book, so I want to have you amplify that somewhat. There was a great deal of concern among some groups and parents in particular that their children, especially boys, were not learning those skills anymore because they weren't living on the frontier. They weren't living out on the prairie or in the woods. They were living in cities and growing up in an industrial society, and they weren't learning the wilderness skills that their ancestors had learned. There was a real movement to get people to go back to some of teaching some of those things. That's where the Boy Scouts came from, isn't it?
Yes, that's exactly right. Around this time, I think 1912 is when the American branch of the Boy Scouts was founded and the Boy Scout Handbook published. And ironically, in that first edition, there are descriptions of how to make fire by rubbing sticks together, which is the skill that most wowed people that Knowles had. In fact, when he did vaudeville appearances, he would make fire on stage. And you might say, why did these people get so excited by this? It's not particularly hard to do, and it was generally a lot of knowledge. But I think you again have to go back to this wilderness anxiety. And people like Teddy Roosevelt at the time were making a lot of noise about how boys were, in their words, becoming effeminate and losing their contact with nature, and that they needed this time in the woods to get in touch with their masculinity. There was a whole lot of anxiety about that at the time. And surprisingly, powerful figures got involved in the debate. There was also, it's a funny other coincidences, there was a lot of debate about so-called nature fakery at the time, too, because much of the nature writing of the period was sentimentalized and not particularly accurate. And Teddy Roosevelt got involved in that, and so did Jack London, a lot of people. But it may well be that Knowles' own book, which was called Alone in the Wilderness, was probably written by a ghostwriter, and a lot of it's probably not accurate. So it definitely fits into that whole sensibility there. But Knowles devotes a whole chapter to the Boy Scouts, and he later was a Boy Scout leader, so that loomed large with him also, and there was definitely a message for the American boy in the whole thing.
I want to come back to that field of study in just a moment. We're going to take a break, and I need to give the phone numbers again, and we'll see who would like to join us to talk about those times, or about the idea that maybe still today we've lost our capacity to go out and survive off the land. There are a lot of popular shows on television now that seem to have that as a theme, Survivor being one of them, and a number of other programs of similar nature. People have to, they're really unusual. We watch them now and we look and gosh, you know, I don't think I could do that. Well, I know for a fact that I'd have a great deal of trouble making fire by rubbing two sticks together, particularly if there was a match at hand. I'm just lazy. Anyway, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 is a toll-free number, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. The book under discussion this hour is Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery, written by Jim Montevalli. And we have him joining us by phone to talk about his book and about Joseph Knowles, and you can too. There are lines available. We'll be right back. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock, John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Here's what's coming up later on. After 4, at issue, it's Your Views on the News. Join Ben Marins with your take on the week's most significant news story. That's after 4 o'clock this afternoon here on the Ideas Network. This hour, we're talking about the book Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. We have the author of that book, Jim Montevalli, with us to talk about the life and times of Joe Knowles. And you can join us as well. Here are the phone numbers, 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee. And we do have a line open, so you can call now and be pretty much assured of getting on the air. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the concept of making sure that in that generation, making sure that the youth had instruction in wilderness survival skills and so forth. And there was, this idea of frontier fakery, and we just kind of started talking about that. I'd like to expand on that a little more. There was, as you mentioned, there was quite a bit of romantic fiction written about the frontier. It hadn't just started then. The dime novels or penny novels or whatever they were, a lot of these Western paperbacks that showed up all over the place had written by people who had probably never been west of St. Louis and didn't really know what went on the frontier, but they had all these great stories of gun battles and rustlers and living on horseback and so forth. So there was a great deal of romanticism about the wilderness and about what went on there. You mentioned Teddy Roosevelt and others.
We can take some of the more familiar figures to people like Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett, and it was pretty much if the legend was more interesting than the truth, they printed the legend. And a lot of what we think we know about, say, Buffalo Bill is pretty much untrue. I mean, he never rode with the Pony Express. He was not a great friend of General Custer. And much of what he did in his own Wild West show was based on half-truths. And many of the actual characters, like Wild Bill Hickok and Annie Oakley and Calamity Jane, actually appeared in his shows playing themselves, but a very much fantasy version of themselves. They most of the time never did the things that they talked about. But those stories had been cemented in place by the dime novels that you mentioned, and those had only glancing references to the truth, and pretty much people didn't expect writers to tell the truth. They wanted a good story. Maybe it grows out of the whole legend of the tall tale, and pretty much our Western legends were established through tall tales. If you look, for instance, at the 18th century writings by Davy Crockett, he wrote the most fantastic things about killing 500 bears at a time and all these things like that. And I think people just found them really fun to read and enjoyed the story and turned the people into a sort of larger-than-life versions of themselves. But the modern biography where the writers are trying to find out the truth and really get to the bottom of what actually happened, that's a pretty modern invention. They were aware, though, at the time that a lot of this stuff was faked. And as I mentioned earlier, there was a discussion called nature fakery. It was a big national topic about whether nature writing was sentimentalized and animals were given human characteristics just to sell more books. And that was true of a lot of writers, including one of the founders of the Boy Scouts, who in his nature writing really stretched the truth. So I get into that because I think it's pretty relevant as to what readers of the time and what the audience of the time would have expected of Joe Knowles. And probably, again, they were just looking for a good, entertaining story, and he was extremely entertaining. So the more I wrote about him in Naked in the Woods, the more I got to like him because he was such an outrageous character.
You mentioned that he later went on and repeated his earlier exploits in Maine out west. I believe when he did this, you talked about him going into the woods and near the California-Oregon border. He didn't go alone. He took some people with him.
Right. He had consultants because there was a lot of pseudo-scientific veneer on what he did. They wanted to give it sort of a scientific inquiry kind of loss, I would say. And in this case, a couple of professors went in the woods with him and observed his every move. And they also wrote byline stories about how he was faring. And interestingly, one of the professors was a guy who had a lot of American Indian knowledge. And he had been an associate of the last wild Indian discovered in California, a guy by the name of Ishii, who was discovered living a primitive lifestyle in California in something like 1912, 1913, and spent a whole rest of his life living in the anthropology museum at the University of California in Berkeley. And this professor, went in the woods with Knowles, had been basically his companion and friend. And he compared many of the things that Knowles did with things that Ishii did, what they did in terms of survival. And later on, Knowles and Ishii met, and they spoke together at a rally in California. And both of them attempted to make fire on the stage. This is for an audience of something like 600 school children. And I find it very funny because Knowles was wearing his bearskin and Ishii was wearing a suit. And Ishii managed to make fire, but Knowles did not. And the kids found this all vastly amusing. But I have a whole chapter that I get into the American Indian connections to this, because Knowles claimed to have got a lot of his knowledge from the Indians and to have lived among the Indians in the Great Lakes for a period of a year and a half. He also pointed out that his father had American Indian ancestry, so that was a big part of his makeup. And I make parallels. I think it's a very funny case. There was a supposed American Indian leader by the name of Gray Owl. This is a bit later than the Knoll story, but he was supposedly a Canadian Indian who had great success on the lecture circuit talking about environmental issues. He was sort of a proto-environmentalist, and he even toured Europe and spoke before the king and queen, and it was revealed only when he died that this supposed Indian chief was actually an Englishman named Archie, and that he had concealed his European background and would become a very successful Indian leader. So there are a lot of other guys. Knowles was not the only one. In fact, they called Knowles the Doc Cook of the North Woods, and Doc Cook was the supposed explorer of the North Pole, who some accused of being a fake. So there are many parallels to what he did.
And yet, at the same time as all this was going on, we have the Sierra Club being formed.
Yes, I think environmentalism could be traced back to this period, and it was also the period when the first national parks and national forests were being established. The whole idea that we should conserve land as wilderness and as open space, that was a very new idea at the time, and that sensibility was starting to build very much, and Knowles was a very early environmentalist. He didn't even like killing things very much, and he wrote a lot about that in the book, that even though he killed some animals to stay alive, he would have preferred not to. So he would have fit comfortably in among today's environmentalists, I would think.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from Megan in Preston, Minnesota. Megan, good morning.
Good morning. My comment, and I thank you for having this topic. My comment is, I'm half Native, half Oglala Sioux. And I grew up on a ranch out west and now choose to live off the grid in Minnesota. And most people think I'm crazy for doing this. They think I probably don't have very much education. And in fact, I have a master's degree in forensic anthropology. So the usual response I get when I go into town is people are always shocked that it can be done. And they also always tell me I should go on to Survivor because I'd probably win. But I think the knowledge of how to survive without technology and civilization is vitally important, because having a degree in anthropology, and having studied history, all civilizations eventually have problems. Not that they all fall, but they all have problems. And being able to have a backup is a good thing.
When you say you live off the grid, what do you mean?
My farm is completely self-sufficient. We have no power lines. We make all of our own power. We do have computers. You know, you can't go completely off the grid, and we do own a car. But we grow, I'd say, 75% of our own food. We hunt deer for meat. And usually we raise a pig and trade half the pig for half a cow. So we're very, very self-sufficient.
How long have you been doing this?
10 years.
Well, that's very impressive, I think. Did the fact that you had a Native American background, was that a factor in your doing this?
Maybe a little. My husband's actually done it longer than I have. He's been doing it for more than 30. His choice was basically partially at the time he chose to go. We both decided to leave the university and not actually finish our PhDs. And his decision was to just go and actually do what he wanted to do in nature, which required him to be in nature. He's an evolutionary ecologist. And my choice was along the similar lines. I didn't really want to live in a city. And as I made this decision, I realized I didn't really want to rely on other people to survive. I'd rather just be able to do it myself. So it was kind of more of a gradual decision than anything else.
One of the points I make in the book, in my book Naked in the Woods, is that people felt they were losing their connection to nature. And you could say that has a lot of parallels to today also, because obviously in our computerized cubicle culture, we're not spending as much time outdoors. And again, there's a whole lot of concern about kids not having much contact with nature. And the average kid spends something like 30-40% less time outside than kids did a generation ago. So I think the same anxieties that were then around in 1913 are still with us today.
That are older, and then I have a 3-year-old daughter. And she's only allowed to watch one movie a night if we have the power for it. And she probably spends 80% of the day outside. And she never tells me she's bored.
Well, that's great, but you realize you have an atypical child there.
I do. I have an extremely atypical child. And I'll let other callers come on because I have a child screaming at me.
Well, more power to you.
So I guess we could say, how are you going to keep them down on the farm once they've seen PlayStation 2?
Well, you know, I do have in my book, I have a whole lot of other nature men and nature women and people who have gone naked into the woods for a long time. And one thing I detail, which I found fascinating myself, was this whole German movement around the same time, actually a little bit earlier than Knowles, of these naked nature men. And a funny thing about them is that they were later transplanted to California, and a number of them camped out under the Hollywood sign. They were called the Nature Boys. And one of them is best known for writing the song Nature Boy, which was recorded by Nat King Cole. So, and it was a huge hit. It still has become a standard, basically. But the guy who wrote that was naked as often as he could be, and a total natural foods person. And they were very influenced by these German people. And I don't know that Knowles was directly related to these people. He wasn't like a nature faddist or anything. And he only really was naked because he believed that he shouldn't take anything in with him. It's not like he had this huge thing about being naked. But I think that probably helps sell the story pretty well.
Let's see. Let's take a call from Cater in Glen Flora. Good morning.
Hey. I'd like to expand on what the last caller was talking about, expand it to society in general. I'm part of a nonprofit here in northern Wisconsin, and what we're all about is trying to help people live more locally and sustainably and have more of a functional knowledge of the land and nature around them. And one of the biggest hurdles that we find is all of this sensationalism about that comes through nature shows and these survival shows that all tends to make the wilderness seem some exotic place that's far away, and survival being about a competition with nature in an emergency situation. A lot of the things that we teach are what people would call survival skills, but we don't call them that. We call them skills about living with nature and consider these to be that you can integrate these into your daily life, and it doesn't have to be going back to the Stone Age, you know, but that being comfortable in nature, being able to be out there and observe what's going on without being afraid of getting lost or dying, and also just understanding the plants and animals, and as this woman was saying, in terms of being able to harvest wild edibles and hunt meat and get materials off the land. I mean, people have been doing this for hundreds of thousands of years, and it's only in the last few hundreds and thousands of years that we have become so alienated that this seems sensational and foreign to us. And
Well, I should make the point that if you can make equations between Joe Knowles and the Survivor type shows, but I would say that what he did in the woods was much less sensationalized than what would happen today. Mm-hmm. In other words, he did impart quite a bit of woods lore in these daily dispatches that he put out, and people probably did learn a little bit about living in the woods and identifying plants. And he made clothes out of weaving reeds together and things like that, and he talked about how to do that. And I would ask the caller, I'd love to know your response to this. Why do you think that in 1913, when you think people would be more in touch with the land and half the population was still living in farms, why was Knowles such a sensation at that time, the idea of this nature man going in naked into the woods? Why do you think he was so warmly received then?
Well, I think in all times that everybody really feels a connection and a fascination with nature, and I think that's a big part of it. And because even people on farms, I mean, there are local farmers here who have their family has been doing it for generations, but there's common animals that live in the woods here that they didn't even know were here. And so I think being rural doesn't necessarily mean that you have a close functional connection with the land, so that even in that time when more people were farm families, the idea, whatever kind of idea they had of this more intimate relation with nature was still something new and exotic to them in a way.
And that's a good point.
Even
I think
more
you're right about that
these days. And I guess I'd just like to say that I think nobody knows what's going to happen in the next couple of generations, but it's possible that it could become very important, not, like I say, to go back to the Stone Age, but to learn how to live locally and use all these natural resources conscientiously. And you cannot do that if you consider nature to be a playground or some virtual, something virtual. You know, it has to be real for you, and you have to be intimate with it. And I'm hoping that people can get past this sensationalism and look at it in more practical, kind of functional ways. But I do think that the survival sensationalism at least gets people starting to think about it. If you can just get them to make the transition between, you know, winning against the competition, against wild nature, to living in, you know, a functional harmony with nature, if you can get over that barrier, then it can, you know, something good could come from it, I think.
Cater, thanks for that call. Yeah, I guess that brings the thought to me. You know, there's no reset button when you're out in the woods alone. I mean, and no one yells cut when something goes wrong, and you don't get to start over again. If you're alone out in the wilderness, if you don't know what you're doing, or if you make a mistake, it can be a serious problem.
I think very much so, and Knowles did have definite setbacks that he wrote about both in his Maine trip and his California trip. In fact, one of the reasons I think that when he went in the woods in California that it wasn't nature fakery is he really wrote about being very close to the edge and almost dying of starvation, and he was much less boastful on that trip than he had been in Maine. And he didn't know the California woods that well. And though he did have many survival skills, he found game very sort of sparse. And he was not in the best shape when he came out. While he emerged from Maine, they were saying that he was the perfect physical specimen when he came out of the woods of Maine. So
he lost a bit of weight between the time he went into the woods in Maine and he came out, according to your book.
Yeah, something like 30 pounds, yeah.
Geez, maybe I ought to do that. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll see who else would like to join us with a question about this book or about wilderness survival or whatever else is on your mind related to our topic here. The book is Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. 800-486-8655 is the toll-free number, 800-486-8655, 414-227-8655. 2050 414 227 850 if you're in Milwaukee. That's a local call for you. My guest is Jim Montevalli, and he is the author of Naked in the Woods. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10:43. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Here's what's coming up next hour. Well, it's Friday at 11 o'clock. That means Garden Talk, a program designed to share knowledge among gardeners, the most optimistic people in the world. After 11, Larry Mueller prepares for the upcoming gardening season with Dane County Extension horticulture educator Lisa Johnson. That's next hour here on the Ideas Network. Well, if you're going to live off the grid, you'd need to be a pretty good gardener and do a lot of praying for good weather, I would think. Let's see. Well, this hour we're talking about the book Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery. One of the things that you get into a little bit in the book is Joseph Knowles' relationship with women. He had a number of wives, and he was involved with some famous women, I think. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, he was married two times, and in his later life, when he lived out in Washington State, he had three women living with him, one of whom he was married to and the other whom he wasn't. And they were living together in this little driftwood cabin on the shores of the Pacific. So that raised a lot of eyebrows about La Dolce Vita on the Pacific coast. But early on, in the third trip into the woods that Joseph Knowles made, the Hearst chain, which was his sponsor, decided that they could jazz it up a bit by sending in a Eve to his Adam. And in this case, the woman they picked was Elaine Hammerstein. Elaine was the first cousin of Oscar Hammerstein III, and Oscar is best known for The Sound of Music and all those other musicals. And Elaine was a silent film star of the period. She was in more than 50 or 60 movies, and most of that was after her time in the woods. But she just started out working for some of Hearst's newsreel companies and was getting her start as an actress. And I think she might have been handpicked for this role by William Randolph Hearst himself. So in some ways, though she certainly looked the part, and the papers had great field day with writing about how beautiful she was and everything, and she looked really, really good in a grass skirt, she was comically ill-equipped to go into the woods. Knowles said all these brave things about how it is better that she didn't know anything because she was a blank slate that he could impose his wilderness knowledge on. But in reality, she was a pretty bad pupil and never really quit after 2 days because she couldn't handle it. And she was shocked to find out she was expected to kill things and get blood on her hands and all this kind of thing. So she dropped out. And Knowles was bitterly disappointed by her inability to cope. So he didn't really get to go into the woods a third time because she proved a non-starter. It's a very funny episode.
You mentioned Hollywood. Did Knowles make movies?
Oh, yes, he did. Yeah, that's very true, too. And unfortunately, those films are lost, but he made two films. One of them, a real Hollywood potboiler with a Western star of the period, Evelyn Selby. And I have stills from that film, and it's quite a melodrama of wilderness survival and all that. The other one is basically a documentary, and these all were released under different names, but documentary filmmakers did go in the woods with him and filmed him doing all kinds of different tasks in the woods. And that movie was shown all over the country to pretty good business. So Knowles did have a Hollywood period, and there are film stills of him and posing in buckskin, and I think he would have been happy becoming a Western movie star, but that's not really what happened. I'm sure he was disappointed by that. He also wanted to be a writer and tried very unsuccessfully to get his wilderness stories published by the magazines and newspapers of the time. So in some ways, even though he had a later career as a very successful artist on the West Coast, and he painted official portraits of some of the governors of Washington and Oregon states, he was frustrated that he didn't get to continue his career as a nature man, which is what he really wanted to do.
Why did he have trouble getting published?
He wasn't a very good writer. He had trouble sticking on the same the same theme. He would start off fairly strongly writing about something and then would wander off into a periphery and end up in a cul-de-sac. And he did this repeatedly because there's many drafts of his stories in his files, as well as many rejection letters from newspapers and magazines. And I think the reason his book did fairly well, and it was generally assumed that his book sold 300,000 copies, which would have been a phenomenal bestseller at the time, but I was able to show that it's probably only 30,000 copies. But even so, that was pretty successful. And I think the reason it worked is he didn't write it. It was actually written or ghostwritten by a Boston Post reporter. And it makes a very good story. So he did well. But on his own, he could tell an anecdote well. And he could be funny as a writer, but he couldn't really maintain the long form kind of writing.
We'll go next to Helen in Milwaukee. Helen, good morning.
Good morning. One of my favorite books growing up was called Boy Scouts in the Wilderness by Samuel Scoville.
Don't know that one.
And I can't find it. It's long out of print. But it was about two Boy Scouts that went into the wilderness naked with a knife and did all these marvelous things. And I kind of think maybe Mr. Knowles might have inspired that book.
When did that come out?
Oh, gosh. Probably in the late 20s or 30s.
Who was the author of that?
Samuel Scoville.
I'll have to look that up. Interestingly enough, the Boy Scouts actually published a edition of Knowles' book much later, near the end of Knowles' life, in I think 1938 or 1939. They actually published an edition of it, and they were very much taken with his wilderness experiences. So it could be that Boy Scouts in the Wilderness is influenced by Knowles or vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. But the Boy Scouts didn't really exist before he went in the woods. They were founded around the same time that he did that, 1912, 1913.
The Boy Scout handbook of that day was a real big seller. In fact, I think your book indicates that it sold almost as many copies as the Bible did in the United States.
Yeah, it was very successful. Of course, the Boy Scouts did a whole lot to erase this idea that boys were becoming too civilized and effeminate and all this kind of thing, and the Boy Scouts took off immediately. There had been scouting groups before the Boy Scouts, and the Scouts were actually formed in England originally, and there was bitter disputes between the American and the British versions of the Boy Scouts, but once it was established, it was immediately very successful. I think it took a while for the Girl Scouts to catch up. And Knowles, I think, was on the sexist side. He didn't really talk about girls needing to get in the wilderness, too.
Well, his writings didn't really speak about women very much at all.
No, that's an odd thing about him. He almost never referred to his wives, or he had two wives, and he didn't really talk about women at all, except to express dissatisfaction with Elaine Hammerstein. But, you know, interestingly enough, this is a really funny story. Later, when he ended up on the West Coast working as an artist, one of the women living in the house with him was also a very gifted artist. And I think Knowles actually signed a lot of work that was really done by her. So you could say that his fakery continued. But she disappeared in the middle of the night, being spirited away by a spiritual medium and magnetic healer. And that part of it is just so bizarre. And Knowles never got over this. He hired private detectives to try to find her and all this. So it's unclear whether they had a romantic relationship or he just really needed her for his art-making business.
Jack in Waukesha, you're next. Good morning.
You're making me think of the Boy Scout stuff, which is not what I called about. I wanted to bring up Dr. Dean Adell. Does the guest know about him?
I remember that name. I'm not sure. Wasn't he a naturopath?
No. He was known as America's Doctor, or maybe still is, and he used to share time with Larry King and Jim Bohannon on, I forget what the radio network is, but he had a national program at night, and then it switched to the weekends, and I kind of lost track of him with all the changes in that field. But he spent some years, and his family, his wife, his children, naked in either the Oregon or Washington woods.
Really?
After becoming an MD, or maybe before becoming an MD. I don't really know, but I would think that it was after.
Which woods was he in?
Somewhere north of California and south of Canada. I don't remember whether it was Oregon or Washington.
Well, I tell this story in the book that Knowles did inspire many copycats, and there were other people that went into the woods trying to duplicate what he did. Most of them weren't able to do it, like a storm would come up or the flies would get bad or something.
Yeah.
Or sometimes the authorities would arrest them.
This would probably have been in the 60s or 70s. I used to listen to him in the 70s and the 80s.
And he talked about this.
And then everything changed. But your screener was familiar with him.
Well, he was on, I used to see him on one of the morning news programs. I don't remember if it was CBS This Morning or the Today Show or Good Morning America or one of those. He used to be a fairly regular health commentator on one of those, didn't he?
That sounds familiar. I don't think I ever saw him. I used to listen to him at night. I'm not into the morning television. My television starts with the evening news or the football game if it's a weekend.
There were many people inspired by Knowles, and they wanted to see whether they could do it themselves. And, you know, it's not surprising that other people have tried it. I mean, you could say that it was something that a lot of hippies tried in the 1960s. There's a very fascinating book that I think I reference in mine called Back from the Land. It's about all the hippies who went into the woods in the 1960s, only to emerge in the 1970s fairly disillusioned. they found it was hard going.
It's not for the lazy. I mean, you're working from can see to can't see, and you have to. Everything you do is about survival. Let's go next to Joe in the Upper Peninsula. Joe, how are things in the UP today?
Well, we got a little bit of snow here, that's for sure. So, a little bit of wet snow.
I would think that would be a great place to go naked in the woods.
Well, naked, I don't know, boy. Let me tell you, I was just telling your screener there that when I grew up in grade school, high school, when I was old enough, my dad, when he had a couple jobs, we had a little beef farm up here, and he would actually, you know, when I was pretty young, I was actually too young to be legal to be hunting, but he would strongly suggest I go in the woods and collect some venison so he can come home and put some in the freezer for a family. That's how we survived. And it's funny because we were kind of ridiculed as a family in our area and, you know, my schoolmates and whatnot because we didn't have much clothes to, you know, new clothes to wear and stuff like that. And actually when I got older, I found out there's a lot more people in my situation up here back then than we realized. I don't know if these guys are better or what, but it's interesting, these same characters that made fun of us in high school, they went on to be engineers and good jobs. I got along with them good, you know. It was funny because now they're coming up here and they're spending $7,000 in Cabela's, brand new clothes, to do the same thing I was doing in my long johns and my, you know, and the stuff, you know, that we just could scrape up. And my wife still complains that I save bread bags. I keep bread bags in the counter because back when I was younger, we used to wear bread bags in between two pairs of socks to keep the condensation down when we were hunting and stuff like that, and I still have a bad habit of saving those, and I got some nice clothes now, you know. So it kind of made me interested because what you guys were talking about, I think it's a basic instinct for people to get back to the nature and the back to the primal stuff, and I think that's a pretty good example because these boys that used to ridicule us and they don't take a good jobs, but they're spending thousands and thousands of dollars while supporting our economy on hunting clothes and all the best rifles and stuff like that, you know, and it's kind of interesting, you know.
Joe, thanks for that call. There's still a lot of back to nature thinking, but we would like to be able to bring our modern conveniences with us, and I think some people get irritated when they go into the woods and their cell phone stops working.
Yeah, and if you go naked into the woods, you don't have any pockets to put your cell phone in.
Well, exactly. I'll tell you what, you don't want to go naked in the woods in the UP, not at this time of year, because
well,
it wouldn't last very long.
Well, the first thing that people ask me about the book is, when did he go into the woods? When I tell them it's Maine, they instantly imagine this guy shivering in the middle of February. Actually, he went into the woods on August 4th, what happens to be my birthday, and he came out in October. And I think the timing was very propitious because you want to go in a little bit later because you want to avoid the black flies. And any earlier would have been bitten mercilessly. So I do think that the timing was probably right. But there's a suspicious lack of insects in the book. You would think there'd be more insects.
Timing is everything.
It is.
And that's true in radio as well, and that means we're actually out of time. Thank you so much for spending this interesting hour talking about your book. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Naked in the Woods.
Naked in the Woods, Joseph Knowles and the Legacy of Frontier Fakery by John Motivelli, who is also the editor of the Environmental Magazine. You can find out more about that online at www.emagazine.com. Rhonda Fanning produced this program. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.